Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
So welcome to GoTo Book Club. Today I have with me Mike Admonson. Mike is an internationally known author and speaker and a consultant with organizations around the world on network architecture, web development, and the intersection of technology and society. He's also authored numerous books and papers, including such great works as Design and Build Great APIs, which I personally am a very big fan of, and also Continuous API Management, RESTful web clients, and microservices architecture. So today, we're going to talk about his new book, which is called RESTful Patterns and Best Practices for APIs Cookbook, Connecting and Orchestrating Microservices and Distributed Data. Welcome, Mike.
Great. Good to see you, Ali. Great to be here.
All right. So I want to start with a question that was the first in my mind when I read the book, which is any intro of you sort of starts with a foremost expert on API design. So why write a book for consumers?
Well, yeah, there are a handful of things. I really sense I have, like you said, I've spent a lot of time on API design on producer side, services side. Design and functionality and patterns and practices. But over the last several years, I've really sensed a shift in the sort of the leverage of the market. I think we're finally getting to the point where we're getting more and more consumers and the balance is starting to shift. And consuming APIs is just as much of a challenge, as it is producing them. And in fact, I'm often to help, designers, to help authors, I tell them to put themselves in the chair of the consumer. What's it like to discover your API? What's it like to try to use your API? What's it like to try to survive changes that are made to your API? So I think taking a sort of a consumer point of view is really, really valuable for everyone. It's sort of the voice of the customer. If you go back to product marketing, you know, in the 80s, it's a jobs to be done kind of idea. People use your API to solve their problem. What is that problem and how do they do it? So I think that's really important. I will say at the same time, this particular recipe book, this cookbook, I think actually shifts perspective several times. There's a whole chapter on design. There's a whole chapter on client patterns. There's a whole chapter on provider patterns. There's a whole chapter on data and then a chapter on workflow. So I think whether you're a consumer or a producer primarily, you can still get a lot out of what I'm putting together here.
I absolutely agree. And as a product manager myself, the perspective of jobs to be done, of what is the point of building that great API or designing that great API, it's always the consumer. So for me, I think it was a perspective that resonated really well. And certainly it was a book that, you know, I don't think that there's much of this out there, but I could definitely see the advantage that you would find for both, you know, sort of the consumer and the producer angle, because it's hard to consider, especially when you're sort of very focused on the technical aspects of implementing an API, I think. That's really what I wanted to talk about, sort of the shift of perspective. And I think this is not just something in the book. I think this is something I've personally been seeing in the industry over the past few years, which is, you know, the shift of perspective from endpoint to behavior, to recipe, to workflow. So, you know, thinking about the kind of cookbooks you might find in your kitchen, some of those provide readers with detailed instructions for creating each recipe. But then there's others that focus on teaching you transferable principles, techniques. Where does your cookbook land?
Yeah, so this book definitely leans towards the concepts and principles idea. But I try to make it tangible with concrete examples. One of the challenges of working in network software, APIs, the space that I typically work in, is you don't have homogeneous technology. So you could be using different programming languages internally. You could be using different orchestration tools, different gateways, different frameworks for doing the HTTP. So it's hard to say this is the exact recipe or this is the exact step to do. So I decided not to do a book on Java or JavaScript or Go or C Sharp. But what I do is a lot of HTTP. So often the examples, while they're narrated, they often say your HTTP conversation will look like this, the request and the response. And that's about as direct as you can get in this kind of network software space. That's a bit of a challenge. And then towards the end of the book, I speak a lot about interactive patterns. So interactive between resources, interactive between services. That's even more difficult to come up with a direct recipe for. So there's lots of diagrams and flowcharts in the latter part of the book as well. So it leans towards that common practice, but I try to come up with at least solid examples that you could recreate on your own.
And I think you do a wonderful job of that in the book and really sort of take people through the thinking behind how you implement some of these different recipes, which is important because not everything is going to be not going to yield itself to an easy sort of step-by-step diagramming. And like you said, the language is also, I think, can provide a barrier to entry if you don't understand how to think through the problem as opposed to, you know, just apply the technology. And I think, you know, for me, that's the conversation. Workflow is the conversation that we need to be having much more. That's the streetlight I want to turn on in the API space. So can you talk a little bit about workflow just as a sort of general guiding principle through the book? Because it's interesting. There's a bit of a duality there, I think. On one hand, you're writing a recipe, which implies a certain set of steps, a certain set of things that you're doing. On the other hand, one of my absolute favorite Mike Edmondson-isms is you are solving problems you never thought of for people you never met. And that's absolutely true as well. So that's not the thing that, you know, the product manager, the API designer intended. It's, I got your Legos and now I'm going to build something different with them. So can you talk a little bit about that duality? Because I think it's a very cool one.
Yeah. That phrase, solving problems you never thought of for people you've never met, has always been a kind of a guiding principle for me for decades. And that leads to building platforms and frameworks often instead of building one-off solutions. So if I understand the job to be done, I can build a one-off solution that solves your problem today. The challenge will be your problem will morph over time. Your problem will begin to change in ways that I don't anticipate. So what I want to do is build something that solves your problem today and solves those new problems tomorrow. And that's much harder. That's more abstract. But what I find so fascinating is I think the HTTP protocol, the way it's designed, the way it's built, is so good for that kind of work. So I do kind of vacillate back and forth between those two. And I think the other thing that's so evident, I think, in the last 30 years of the web itself is that the value of the web is in connection. It's in the white space between things rather than just the things themselves. And that's workflow. So it's important that I know how to handle a payment. It's important that I know how to handle schedule and manage shipping. It's important that I know how to do a shopping cart and picking from stock. But the real value is when I can get all of those connected, all of those working together. And often that starts to look like that problem that we hadn't thought of, the way it's connected and who connects it and how it interacts with other things are the things that I can't think of. So I want to empower people. That's sort of the message of the book, to make sure that they remember there are people you've never met that are going to use this material. And that's sort of why I talk the way I talk about the examples in the book.
You know, a slight, perhaps, you know, going off course or something like that, but HTTP, I think for me, it's sort of fascinating to think about the fact that it is still getting the job done. And, you know, was designed for such a different world that we operate in. So, you know, one hand, it shows that it can be done. But I thought that was actually a really interesting aspect of kind of what you were calling out in some of these recipes and the reliance on HTTP as well.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Should I be excited or afraid of AI? The answer is yes, it's both.
Things are going to look so different in the next couple years. You will not be ready for the disruptions that are going to come. I'm Jeff Nielsen, host of Digital Disruption, the go-to podcast for technology leaders.
Our generation's conflict, I think, is going to be emotional, not economic.
The companies that are going to win are the ones that have a couple of characteristics.
Stay ahead of the curve with Digital Disruption, available now on your favorite podcast platform.
Yeah, I will say that I have one of the lines of conversation that I've had with lots of people over the last 5 or 8 years or so is challenge them to think about a time when we don't have HTTP, when we have something else, when HTTP is no longer powerful. Well, I keep getting reminded how flexible and powerful and resilient the HTTP protocol continues to be, because I agree with you 100%. It was designed for static documents, linking documents back and forth. It wasn't designed for application hosting. It wasn't designed for component building. And in fact, early component building really went badly. You know, we had these plugins, ActiveX and all these other kinds of applets and things that really didn't work out really well. Yet HTTP continues and continues to grow and morph. So I'm really, really fascinated by the resilience of this particular protocol. There's a series of them, email and chat and several other things, that all kind of come out of those late 80s, early 90s. I think we're very lucky to be working on a platform as powerful and as resilient and as flexible as HTTP. And that's one of the reasons I love it.
I have no arguments from you there. You know, as we're sort of talking about this, so we're talking about jobs to be done, we're talking about APIs and, you know, the concept of workflow, both creating the components to build workflows, even workflows that you don't as a creator anticipate, but also, you know, engaging with the workflows that you intend. I guess what I start to come to sort of think of, especially as a product person, we don't always get it right the first time, right? So there's a lot of challenges, not only in building these services the first time, but also in evolving them. What do you see as some of the biggest ones and things that you may address in the book?
The biggest challenge, the thing that I run up when I talk to people, and it sort of gets reflected in the book, is often we don't think in the same time scales that a lot of these protocols really lead us into thinking. We can think in the timescales of decades, of years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years for our designs. And that's a challenge, because so many things change. So I think one of the things that comes in this sort of evolutionary nature is building systems that can be changed over time without disrupting the rest of the participants, the rest of the connectors. You know, in real life, this happens all the time. You know, I change furniture in my room. I move to a new location. I change my outfits. I change the way I look, and I buy new glasses, whatever. We have all sorts of change that we deal with every single day. I change the way I get to work in the morning. But we often, when we build computer systems, we don't build in that ability to take a different route, to dress things up a little bit differently, to do things in a different order. And I think that's a big failing. So I think we need to, if there's anything that that I'd love to be known for, is helping people sort of level up to that notion where change is a feature and not a bug, right? So I'm constantly trying to help people figure out how to think about this in a way, like what happens if it was rearranged? So a lot of the recipes throughout all of the clients, servers, data, workflow, a lot of them talk about making sure that if you make a change later, things don't break. And I think that's probably the biggest challenge.
That it is really interesting to me too, because I think most people have heard of sort of Yagni, you're not going to need it. And sometimes that becomes a proxy for, I'm just going to build for today, which it shouldn't be, in my opinion, because it means that you're not necessarily dealing with the future, which hopefully will have, for example, issues about scaling or issues about, exposing potentially aspects of your data model. And that can be a really big problem, I think, too, because you then wind up building and rebuilding systems and incurring technical debt when, if you kind of thought about like the reality of your situation when you first started, it might not have come to that. And it's not something that necessarily can be tested at the level of the spec either. It's something that, it's the interaction between these things, it's delivering the capability that you really start to see some of those challenges become problems writ large, I guess.
Yeah. I think one of the things is, This is a our discussion is kind of a perfect example of the challenge. I think we want to think ahead, but we don't want to overbuild, right? That's what the Yagni principle really tries to remind us. You ain't going to need this, at least not now, right? So I think we have to be able to build systems that we can go back and rebuild later. Alan Kay had this great line, that what you want to be able to do is build something and then go back after you've learned and rebuild some other part that you had built earlier. But you want to do it safely, right? So you want to go back. You want to learn from the future and then make changes. So that's what I'm trying to encourage people to do is build what you need for today, but leave yourself an out. Leave yourself a doorway. Leave yourself a chance to be able to tack something on later. And I think that's a big part of it, adding on is a lot of the way resilient systems work. They don't replace, they add on. And what happens is you sort of, like if you think of biological systems, we have all sorts of, we have the little toe and with the appendix and the tonsils. We have all these extra things that we used to have a role, but they're really just kind of add-ons now. They're really not too important. But we don't get rid of them because taking them out is painful and complicated. So, and the same thing with large scale systems. I think you have to think of the fact that this will add on. This will be changed over time. So trying to encourage people to continually accept the Yagni, but also prepare for the fact that circumstances will change in the future.
It's almost like you should over architect, but under build, like follow the Yagni on the build.
That's actually very good. That's a very good idea. It's a version of hope for the best, but plan for the worst, right? It's kind of the same thing. I like this idea a lot. Over architect and under build or something, right?
Yeah.
Is that what you said?
Yeah, just the idea of like thinking about those future states and future possibilities without necessarily building the thing to deliver them yet, but making sure that the, again, and Mike Edmondson word that I love, affordances are there within the system, which I think, for me, again, as a product manager, you have to think in those terms because whatever you deliver the first time absolutely will not be the right thing. Very humbling, I guess.
Well, let me lean on your product experience, right? I mean, a lot of times you do the research, you figure out what that product could be, but often the very first product you put on the shelf may be sort of a limited, like it's targeting a market or it just has a certain set of features, right? And then you sort of see how that goes. And if it goes well, you can add to the family, right? You can expand the product or you can add more products. Is that right? Am I kind of, maybe it's oversimplified.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that is sort of definitionally in the era of Agile, how we try to do it. And, it's more about sort of trying to understand from our research what that core use case is, like what are the things you absolutely must have, but also what is the thing that could provide the most value. And then I think being humble enough and unbiased enough to see, okay, I've provided value. Do the people like it? Like, are people using it? And are people using it in the way that in my vision and our team's vision, I thought that they would? That's
right.
The building things for people that are going to use it a different way. And, it's true of APIs. It's true of product.
Right. Because that's the pivot, right? Suddenly I realize, mm-hmm. I'm not building a game engine. I'm actually building a communication network, right? Okay, mm-hmm. So let's embrace that. Let's do that. So I think that's right. And I think that, you know, really is part of the way I'm talking about these and all these recipes is being prepared for serving the needs that you haven't quite figured out yet.
And recognizing how those needs change as the user's engagement with your system, your tool, your interface change, because that is also an inherent proposal. So I want to shift a little bit because I think we're actually kind of touching a little bit on the next topic that I was thinking of covering with you, which is collaboration and risk. So collaboration and risk, I love pairing these two concepts because collaboration is something that everybody loves and is tremendously excited about. And risk is like clearly what we all want to avoid. but definitionally, collaboration means something is going to exist outside of your individual or your team's control. And that is actually an inherently risky proposition. So, you know, one of the things I was looking at in the book is like, does this book, the recipes in the book, help organizations and help developers mitigate that inherent risk around collaboration?
Yeah, I love this idea, this sort of counterbalance or the fact that the two come together. I talk a lot in the book about the notion that you can't eliminate bugs, but you can survive them. You can't eliminate the possibility of something going wrong because you don't control everything, right? So part of this, I think part of the theme we're kind of talking about here is this notion of, you know, people you've never met and problems you've never thought of has a lot to do with the fact that you're not in control of things. You're not in control of when service A changes their interface that you're consuming. You're not in control of when the consumers no longer think this is an interesting thing or they start using your tool in unexpected ways. So that becomes part of the collaboration. What you have to do is there's a level of trust that has to go on to make sure that everyone, can participate. But there's also a level of self-defense that has to go on to mitigate unexpected things. So, unexpected things are not just people. There are also technologies there. The server goes down. The service is overloaded. We ran out of stock. I mean, you have to prepare for all of these kinds of things. The example I think this is in the book, but the one that I often use is this notion that, you know, somebody wants to order a product and you send a message saying how many are in stock. And you send a message to the service figures out how many are in stock, and the service creates a message and sends you the answer. Well, by the time you get the answer back, that's probably not the right number anymore, right? There's time and things change, and you have to sort of protect yourself against even minor little things like, yeah, well, they were in stock, but, you know, now all the seats are sold and there's no front row seat for you at the concert. We have to build all of these things into the system. And that's where that risk, I think, comes in. So when you collaborate, when you build the collaboration, and I love this notion of thinking of it as something outside your own sphere, you have to be prepared for what risks might come up and even be prepared for risks you haven't thought of. There's a kind of a self-defense part of that. And that's a big part of the way I describe, especially the data chapter, where you're really pretty worried about what's happening to data you're in charge of. And that's all part of the process, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, data is a place where it becomes very apparent, like, you know, your book example or whatever, like this is the place where things can go wrong. This is the place where things may become inconsistent in the process of you know, transmitting and receiving messages. And this is also a place where we can expose ourselves. You know, I think some of the big challenges we're seeing now with GraphQL, for example, is because people were like, well, we all understand our data model. So we're just going to basically back end for front end. We're going to just like throw it out there. And, you know, when you do that internally, there's still risk involved. But when you start externalizing it, there can be a lot of potential security risk as well to the data. So I think maybe, again, a little bit of my background peeking through, security is a topic that I think is finally, for APIs, getting some way overdue attention. And in my opinion, a lot of the conversations that I've been hearing about it are shifting the responsibility onto the producers, like build a secure thing. But I love this analogy of you could have a house that has a lock, that has, you know, a security monitoring system and all these other things. But if I leave the house and I don't lock the doors and I don't turn on the security system, none of those things are going to help. So is there an aspect that you're addressing in the book about security, or is that something that, you know, kind of comes outside, but is something we should be thinking about?
You know, it's a classic challenge. There are some security elements in the book there, but I didn't do a chapter on security. And part of the reason is some of what you were just saying here, because I think it's, we're sort of getting to the point where security is embedded in things rather than a standalone unit. Security isn't some gateway that we have to pass. Security is our behavior, just like you said about, I have to lock the doors and take the key out of the car and all these other kinds of things. I have to behave responsibly. So I toe the line a little bit, but really not enough. Honestly, if I had more time, I would write more. But I just haven't been able to do that. But I do think I really like the point you're making, which is it isn't just a producer problem. It's an everyone's kind of problem. And I think when we think about other kinds of transactional systems, especially if you move to the financial end, fintech and transactional systems, we're constantly trying to figure out how to design systems that have security built into them, or that take advantage of other kinds of information that we know, so that the secure behavior is kind of widely distributed. A great example is most credit card systems. This is a great messaging model where there's lots of collaboration and risk. Most credit card systems have a backup system. They will take a certain amount of float, a certain amount of errors, a certain amount of, like if you lost your card, they're not going to put you in jail if somebody buys a boat on your card, right? But at the same time, they also had these patterns where they make sure that, you know, that was kind of unusual that you moved to this, you were in this city that you'd never been in before and you bought a very expensive suit. Is that actually you? You know, we have these ways of thinking about it, all the way to blockchain, where we want to actually infuse the message itself with the validation information. So I think APIs, we're getting to that spot where it is everyone's responsibility to behave in a secure manner and to mitigate against their own kinds of risks while they collaborate with other people.
And I think a lot of that is around data. It's interesting. A recent article that I read was talking about sort of digital transformation. So one of those things that, you know, the execs all love to hear about, but digital transformation in banking. And one of the observations was that not a lot is happening internally. And I think, you know, I spent many years as a tooling vendor, so I talked to a lot of banks in the course of those years. And I actually think that it's not entirely true. I think that they are using, as you said, you know, machine learning models against your transaction history so that they can understand what looks atypical for Mike as opposed to what looks atypical for myself. But at the same time, I think it's not necessarily translating outwards and how you could, but, and again, it could be that they're afraid of how to expose that data externally. So it's an interesting kind of duality, because it really is about that relationship, not just the relationship between, you know, two endpoints or something like that, but the relationship between the producer and the consumer when the producer is a human, perhaps, and the consumer is a human that are trying to transact a piece of business.
Yep. I really agree with that. I think, again, it goes back to this idea of relationships. You know, here's a not so popular point of view. I talk about this a little bit in the book, but not a lot. And that is that often people think data is an asset. I think of data as a liability. Data is the evidence of activity. Data is the left behind remnants of something you did. I bought a product. I wrote an article, all these other kinds of things. As soon as that data is sitting somewhere, that's a thing that can deteriorate, that can break, that can get lost, that can get stolen, that can get misinterpreted. It's a liability. So designing systems where you think of data as the way to solve a particular problem, I think kind of levels us up, where data becomes, it's the message, right? It's the message we're passing so that we can get something done, so that we can affect some outcome. It's the outcome I'm interested in. And if I can ignore the data after that or deep six the data somewhere where I can analyze it later offline, that's just fine. I want to actually limit the amount of reliance I have on a particular single source of truth or these other things, because in real life, we don't have those kinds of things. We don't have a single source of truth for the news or for any other aspect of our lives. And I want to kind of build systems that operate in that same way. So I think of data very often as evidence of something that we did. And now that evidence is something I'm liable for that I need to take care of or protect in some way.
I think that's a really great point vis-a-vis data and also about the consistency of systems. I mean, if you sort of talk to sort of the web 3.0 crowd, this is a distributed system. Inherent difficulty in distributed systems. Stuff is not consistent. When you talk about event systems and the concept of eventual consistency, like, eventual consistency can be kind of like a hopeful term. hoping that we get to that point.
I agree. It's eventually consistent if at some point you stop.
Right. Exactly. And these systems do not. In fact, they constantly evolve. The data in them evolves. The interactions are, in some points, millions and millions per second. And so, how do we talk about this high intensity, high velocity, data flying everywhere, data in motion system, and evolvable architecture? How do we bring those concepts together? And how does the book do that?
The way I try to do this in the book, I actually struggled as to whether or not I would have a separate chapter on data. I had a chapter on services and a chapter on clients, a chapter on workflow, and I added a chapter on data because of this thing we talked about how I see it as a liability, as a challenge. But if you look at the book, there are recipes in the producer chapter, recipes in the data chapter, and recipes in the workflow chapter that are actually very, very similar. In other words, it's sort of this kind of all this thing being infused. If things change over time, there's services that need to be able to adapt to that. If the data changes over time, there are clients that need to be able to adapt to that. And there's workflow that affects the change of data. So I think I want to get us to think about these as sort of the circle of life, that like these are all related anyway, and not think of them as how do we get the two to interact, but just the fact that they are already kind of stuck together. So some of the recipes actually point ahead and point back to each other. The recipes about how to make sure that, how to deal with a flood of data is often using queues, in an implementation detail. My producer chapter has ideas about, how to deal with, lots and lots of transactions, and that's to use queues. So then very often I think we end up, if we think of them in sort of a holistic way, they kind of help each other out. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's kind of the way it works in my head.
I mean, I think the problem with it is an inherently interrelated problem. And if you don't deal with it when you're, no matter what end of the stick you're tackling at the particular moment, you have to. It's just because the other part is not going to go away. So I like that. So I want to know, I'm not sure if we'll have time overall, but maybe we can talk a little bit about how the data that's in motion, how the services that are in motion interact with each other. And I always think, and I'm totally dating myself here, I always think of the movie White Christmas, Danny Kaye doing the dance they're doing choreography whenever we start talking about the differences between orchestration and choreography. Yeah. Made it sound like choreography was like something special, something different. But when we're thinking about like the recipes and the workflows, there's definitely trade-offs between, deciding on something a little bit more stable and orchestrated or sort of centrally organized and a choreographic approach. So what for you is the difference, or is there like something that kind of calls out using one pattern versus another?
Yeah, there's definitely a difference. I've sort of adopted that same notion of thinking as choreography is this collaborative activity of people on the stage, right? By the way, my favorite song from that movie is Sisters. I don't know if you remember that song, but there's a great story behind why there are two versions of that song in the movie. But anyway, we carry on. The other idea of this is, rather than collaborators on the stage, is some central person that or central source that kind of manages the flow and the pace and the organization of all the pieces. That's typically thought of as orchestration, right? So I like both of those, and there are times when each of those are really important. There are times when it's a tight enough integration or a tight enough collaboration where I don't need somebody telling me what to do. We can work this out together. And that's where I think this idea of choreography works really, really well. But there are also times when there are lots of complicated interactions or various interactions or lots and lots of choices. And it may take a lot of time. Like days, maybe even, to complete a workflow. Then I think you need some kind of central source that is kind of coordinating or at least managing or nudging in some kind of way. And that's where I think orchestration helps a lot more. Now I take one more step to it. And this really dates or stretches as well. In a previous life, I spent a lot of time playing jazz music, improvisational music. And in improvisational music, everyone has the same chart or graph. Everyone has the same bits of information, but we each play our own part. The bass, the drums, the keyboard, the guitar, the saxophone, the trumpet, so on and so forth. We all have our own versions of this. And every time we do that song, it's slightly different, right? And that's more of what I think the HTTP universe is really about. We each have the same basic plan, but we each contribute in unique ways, and doing it one way doesn't mean it's going to be done the same way over and over again. So that's a sort of a different level to it. And that's where I think HTTP is actually really good at this. So I think we need all of those. I think we need the case where there's some tight collaboration where we practice and make a performance. You know, that's Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers, all those things like that. I think there are also cases where we each practice our own part. We do our own thing. And when it's my turn, I will go ahead and process the payment. That's the orchestration idea. And then I think there are these cases where there's sort of loose collaboration, where I could, what I talk about in the book are these ideas of being able to find and bind, to discover in real time the services that are available in order for you to solve a problem. So it's not even planned ahead of time. It's like, when it comes time, if somebody says, I need a payment, I'll go find a service that does payment, interact with her, and then that's all I need. So I think we need all of those, not just one of those, but all of those to create a successful ecosystem.
I think you've heard it here, folks. In both jazz and in APIs, we never play anything the same way once.
That's exactly right. At least that's the way it works for me. I don't know.
So, you know, this is fantastic. I think one of the other aspects, though, that as a former tooling vendor, which makes it sound like I'm in a special meeting here, but as a former tooling vendor, one of the things that sort of struck me, I think, was, you know, you created a lot of these recipes and everything, and I know very well what's on the side, you know, for people who are exploring APIs, for people who are implementing them, designing them, and even for testers. But did you notice any place where the tooling had not caught up with developers' needs? And, you know, kind of how did that influence how you were writing the book?
Yeah, that was, there's a combination of things. So I tend to, in the stuff that I write about, I tend to write often about the next horizon. I write about things that we could be doing but aren't. And there are lots of good reasons why we are not doing them. Cost, expense, technical details, not all the tools that are available. So I found when I was working on the book that, this is a really important principle. There is not a good process or tool that is widely used right now for this. In some points of the book, I say, you know, there are about four or five different ways that you can actually record the definition of an API or describe the workflow of an API. You'll have to decide on one. So what happens to me, and if people have read some of my other books, they probably realize this, I tend to wander off and write some other kind of tool or some other kind of thing to fill in a gap or something like that, because I often am running experiments. I need to kind of build these things. So it turns out there are a handful of tools, actually just a couple tools that I consistently used while I was working on the book and had to either kind of build myself or cobble together from existing bits and pieces. I think the challenges that I see have to do with describing APIs and API interactions at a more abstract level than an implementation level like OpenAPI or Async API or Protobuf or schema definition languages. These are really powerful implementation details that I must have in order to complete work. But often when I'm working on my projects, I'm not sure if I want this service to be implemented as GraphQL or implemented as gRPC or implemented as a simple REST CRUD. So I use a sort of a generic language to describe all of those and then generate those implementation details. That's a tool that I think we don't have a really good version of. We got a few. So I end up working on a thing called ALPS, which is a profile semantics language that I think some people may have heard of. At the same time, often I'm testing interactions between services, and it's kind of fiddly for me to keep writing in a language like C# or Java or Node or something like that. So what I want is a sort of a higher level, almost like curl, but for workflow. So I ended up creating a REPL tool, a command line tool that has memory that allows me to interact sort of like a browser, but through just APIs. So I can actually script API interactions and script interactions with other services, find services that match, and then use them in real time. And that's turned out to be another project that I worked on last year called, I think it's called a hyper client or, and so I ended up building this language. I think none of these are production ready or product ready. As a product manager, you would you'd probably say, well, these are quite far from being stable, but they helped me solve my problems. And hopefully as people read through the material, even in a year or two, they'll be like, oh, no, we already have a tool for that. And that would be great, mm-hmm. right? So I think the ones that really touched on, hit me as I was working is this high level abstraction of how to describe workflow and describe interactions and the actual running of them in a sort of an abstract kind of way. So those are the things that I actually built. I refer to them in the book, and I think I point to the repos on them as well.
Yeah, I mean, I love the idea that tooling evolves from a developer's needs. And, we've had the Lego blocks that are provided to us by specifications for so long, but in, another case of sort of looking for your keys under the streetlight instead of looking for your keys where you drop them.
That's right. Like, but the light is so much better here.
This is sort of I know. It's like, well, this is where the light is. But this is sort of the challenge of specifications is specifications have allowed us to describe in great detail these aspects of an API, but, something that could even be used to approximate in REST and OAI, like links, we don't use. I would love to do a study and see the number of API specifications that are in production that use links, for example, just as a sort of things you can do with telephone number. So we don't really deal with that next level of abstraction, but the next level of abstraction is also where the value lies, because in the end, each individual endpoint provides a piece of the story, but not the entire narrative of the thing you want to do, the way you want to implement it.
Yeah, I think you hit on a really important point, and that is that this last point that you made about each individual endpoint. I think one of the big challenges we've had over the last decade or so of doing API things is we really focus on encapsulated APIs. This is the API for my service. This is the API for my company. We don't actually have a lot of examples of successes of integrated APIs or interoperable APIs. This is the service that uses all these different companies' APIs. So designing a workflow where we're not in charge of all the services, designing a client that isn't just bound to one domain, but actually uses lots of domains to create their solution, that's sort of that next level abstraction that I think we're starting to come close to. So I think a lot of workflow focus, a lot of choreography language, things like these are starting to get us toward that place. And that's really, I think, one of the key messages of the book is to think about HTTP as a world that you can interact with, not just the one thing that you built in the world and then focus just on that.
I actually think that was one of the most for me at least, one of the most compelling sort of dualities of the book is that, you know, you kind of inherently you're separating the meaning and the message format, you know, like that's just, that's what you do. And you can reuse vehicles of, you know, conveyance, like messages and stuff like that. But then it's the compilation of all of them that actually results in, you know, the thing that you wanted to do. And that is a really powerful aspect, I think, of the recipe approach and the sort of teaching technique approach of the book, which I personally really enjoyed as a sort of more non-technical reader. So absolutely love that. We've gone through a lot of different sort of aspects of what you cover in the book, who the book is for. But I want to sort of bring it back to you as an author. Because, you know, as somebody who's done some teaching myself, like whenever you teach, you learn something too. So what is something that writing this book taught you?
Oh, a lot, which is why it's taking me so long. I think probably one of the things that I kind of suspected, but I really didn't like tangibly understand until I actually started working on the book, is over the years, I've sort of collected all these habits, these, oh, you should design this thing this way. And I don't really remember why. I don't know why I do the things I do. That part of my brain is locked away somewhere. All I know is that you do it this way and it's working really well. It's worked really well before. So, as you mentioned, as a teacher, when I start to, you know, answer the question why, when a student asks me, well, why is that important? Suddenly I have to kind of rethink and I have to go back and I have to go to not necessarily first principles, but at least replay some of the alternatives. And, not surprising, there are certainly times when I'm going through and I'm kind of digging back on my history and I realize, actually, that's not a good reason. That is not necessarily, that might have been true 10 years ago. That's not true today. So I've had to learn. I've had to relearn and, you know, put on that student's cap. So one of the things that's happened to me in this book is as I start to explain why I do things the way I do, I am also inspecting the reasoning behind it. And I end up learning a new way to do something. I ask some questions, I look at some evidence, I talk to some people and suddenly realize, oh yeah, this is actually a much smarter way to tackle this problem. So I think one of the biggest things throughout the book is as I've had to learn myself why I do the things I do and how I can improve them along the way, which is kind of what I want all the readers to experience as well. Oh, I've seen these names or I've seen these things, why is this so? And there are certainly cases, I mentioned this in the book, especially in the design area and a couple other areas, where there's no science here. You can make choices yourself on what, you know, what fits best in your environment. So giving people the tooling and the opportunity to make their own choices to enable their own teams in their own ways is also really, really important to me. So I think this, you know, writing is always a learning experience, but this in particular has been a really valuable experience for me.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Absolutely. Great to talk with you, Allie.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.